Hello, you are back with Art History on Fire, the interview series exploring the current state of the field of art history through conversations with a variety of US-based art historians. Once again, your hosts are myself, Rebecca Tucker. I'm professor at Colorado College, and
Deborah Hutton, professor at the College of New Jersey. We're here to talk about the future of our field. As we all know, higher ed and the arts are facing a variety of threats, and the discipline of art history is certainly not exempt.
And yet, at the same time, we've been noticing that art history is in a dynamic and innovative phase. When we attend museums, we see that attendance is up and general interest in the arts is surging.
So, in this series, we talk to art historians on the ground to learn from them about what is happening and why, and to gather ideas for moving forward.
So it's my pleasure to introduce our interviewee for the third installment of our series. We speak with Dr. Michael Fowler, who is Associate Professor of Art History in the Art and Design Program at Eastern Tennessee State University in Johnson City, Tennessee. Professor Fowler is an award-winning faculty member and a prolific scholar in the field of art and architecture of the ancient Mediterranean and West Asia. He works on a wide variety of topics, including material religion, the visualization of violence, time and memory, the social construction of identity, and human-animal relations. That's a lot of things. As an interdisciplinary scholar, Professor Fowler is affiliated with the departments of Classical and Medieval Studies, Religious Studies, and Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies programs at Eastern Tennessee State, an impressive individual that we are excited to talk to.
Absolutely. And as always, you can find a transcript of this interview as well as more information on Dr. Fowler and this interview series on our Substack, Art History on Fire, and on the project's website hosted by Colorado College.
Let's get started.
We are delighted to welcome Dr. Michael Fowler. Michael, thank you for agreeing to be part of this interview series. Rebecca and I are excited to hear more about your work and your thoughts on the current state and future of art history.
Thanks for having me. I'm really looking forward to today's conversation.
Absolutely. We are so pleased to have you here. In our intro that precedes this interview, we give a very brief summary of your work as a scholar and teacher. And though we left out some details, including the very important fact that you are a graduate of Colorado College,
That is
full
correct.
disclosure.
Proudly.
Besides that, we didn't go into much detail because we wanted to give you the opportunity to define yourself and your work. To that end, here's our first question for you. How would you describe yourself and the type of art history that you practice?
So I will say briefly at the outset that I would describe myself as a historian of the visual and material culture of the ancient Mediterranean and West Asia. But before I proceed any further into discussing that those choice descriptions of myself, I would note actually a great segue of discussing that I did my undergraduate degree at Colorado College is that my path into art history was rather indirect, really quite circuitous. When I was at Colorado College, I never set foot in the art department. I didn't take an art class. I didn't take an art history class. I was a sociology and philosophy double major. So steeped in the humanities and the social sciences, and went on from there, I developed an interest as an undergrad in religion and the history of religion, which has persisted with me through my work to this day. It's one of the main topics that I work on as an art historian. But I didn't arrive at art history in particular until after an intermediary graduate degree in religious studies. So I first went to do my master's in religious studies and then a classical archaeology degree. And then only at my PhD level did I actually formally study in a department of art history.
I'm
So
sure it was our loss, Michael, not to have you with us all those years.
I'm flattered. But in some ways, it's maybe that is by design, right? I don't believe in that some kind of teleological guidance of me towards art history, but I think why I mentioned this unusual background, it'll be relevant later to what I imagine will be some conversations about my pedagogy and how I connect with students, many of whom come from very similar backgrounds as my own, and I can return to that in a moment. But also that my approach as a scholar of antiquity is thoroughly interdisciplinary, and that is informed, I believe, by the fact that I benefited from so many different disciplinary perspectives and methodologies, analytical approaches, before I even started thinking about the material and visual, right, world, culture, as one primary category of evidence through which I could think about all the things that in the humanities and social sciences that I'd studied previously were actually what I was interested in. But ultimately, through graduate work, I realized that I wanted to work not with texts primarily as my source for the history, initially for the history of religion, because I realized as an art historian that one of my main interests, kind of from the social science perspective, is I would say my approach as an art historian is really anthropological. So in at least two main senses. One is that the kinds of questions that drive my interests are at their heart human questions. They are phenomena, experiences that confront human beings across the entirety of our right modern anatomically modern human beings' history so far as we can go back in time. And I love that when I'm teaching something like Paleolithic art. One of my main selling points from the beginning is that art is the oldest surviving form of communication human beings have, not texts. I love dance. I love music, right? They certainly existed, but how do we actually reconstruct or talk about them? So, art for me, in a kind of anthropological sense, is this conversation happening across time and across cultures that doesn't privilege linguistically based cultures, right? And we can find some kind of visual and material expression across. Right, the history of humanity. And of course, that connects with the kinds of questions I'm interested in, the material religion, or violence, or gift giving as a phenomenon, or monuments and commemorative practices, right? Things that we can locate across human societies and history and can think about them comparatively, right, alongside one another. The other side of that why I'm interested in visual material culture, and I don't say art, is that I'm not just interested in fine art, right, high art, those kinds of cultural expression, that I'm interested in humanity broadly construed from the most popular and so-called low manifestation of culture all the way up to the high. And so that's where the archaeologist and the art historian in me are always in conversation of the different kinds of information that complement. Sometimes contradict or offer different perspectives than the textual record may offer us, an insight into people who otherwise go unremarked in history if we don't look at certain kinds of visual and material evidence. So I would say that interdisciplinary perspective, that social science background has really informed how I approach the history of art. Look, I probably have a lot more to say, but I'll kind of cede the floor so we have a conversation rather than
Well,
a monologue here.
I'm curious about this broad definition that you give of the way you practice the field. Do you find that you sit comfortably in an art history space as a scholar, as a teacher, as an academic? And is that because art history itself has that interdisciplinary permeability? Or is it particularly true for classical studies, right, where you have a lot of that archaeology, religion already happening?
I would say I am exist rather comfortably, I think, within an art historical space, precisely for the kind of latter propo explanation that you gave, that I think art history is inherently interdisciplinary. And I think that's a corollary to some of my kind of earlier remarks I said about my interdisciplinary background was that I found my way to a discipline that, although it has its own history and its own kind of institutional boundaries, its own proper methods and primary kinds of information it's looking at, art history is itself thoroughly interdisciplinary and is pretty willing to incorporate perspectives from different disciplines that and adapt them, right, and make them work. So I think that was a natural place where not only are art historians looking at the kinds of things that I wanted to look at, it is a space where interdisciplinarity is part of our practice and is encouraged rather than discouraged.
Yeah, that is part of what we love about it, right? Yeah.
I wonder in that way that, I think all three of us would say that's a strength of art history, but I also wonder if that's some of its downfall. That the interdisciplinarity that makes it such a rich field also makes it seem like other people in other fields also can do the things we're doing. And then, I'm thinking, Michael, about your hesitancy around the term art history because you want to talk about all different kinds of visual and material culture. And I'm totally with you. Is that descriptor art history seems so limiting that then people in other fields feel like they're doing things art historians aren't doing because they're looking at that visual material culture. In other words, I think it came up in an earlier conversation Rebecca and I had a couple times, like, is the name itself art history part of what's, if there is a crisis in art history right now, we can talk more about that. Is part of that really the name of what we do and this older idea of what that is, that it's only about objects and not really about the people who use those objects?
Right. And I think that emphasis I had earlier on the kind of social, scientific, anthropological is that I really want the humans, right, to be centered in that conversation. But also, I'm a little bit of an animist as an art historian. So I'm also very much interested in the treatment of the object as a thing that has agential power and is actually embedded in social relationships with us. So I extend personhood to the objects, right?
Oh,
Really,
I love that.
steps, right, of our study. So for me, that the social approach, it also involves the things that we whose affordances, right, we are interacting with. So absolutely, I don't want to lose the thread of your earlier point, which is really excellent. And that is something that I think we struggle with. This on the one hand, the terminology, something like art history, and then a similar fraught situation of other kinds of area studies, like women's and gender studies or American studies, right, where their methods have been so thoroughly incorporated into other fields that people begin to question what is the need for a standalone discipline when everyone has learned from the insights of the pioneering theorist of gender and sexuality, right? So I feel that, right, that maybe our interdisciplinarity, the adaptability of our methods, that we can in a way be absorbed, right? It's like, oh, well, we've learned the lesson from all of you. Do we really need this freestanding discipline? What is actually distinctive about your discipline that can't so easily be incorporated, right? Appropriated by another discipline. Yeah, I think that is a point that's well made. And I think we've struggled with that even from the turn of the millennium with other art history programs adding visual studies, right? These different kinds of fields where part of that movement was towards democratizing or expanding the scope analytically of the kinds of culture that we were interested in. But I think one of the unfortunate consequences of that I think could be a place where we re-emphasize or reassert the distinctiveness of art history is with no shade to the digitization of a lot of our culture. We are like thing people. We are materiality people. And I think what gets lost in visual studies is that we too quickly move from speaking about the thing in front of us as an image, and it dematerializes the objects that we are studying. And I think that is something that we have in spades as a discipline, is confronting the not just the dematerialized image, but the medium as the kind of vehicle, right, for the thing that we are seeing, and that the material and the making, right, the facture, these are actually significant components of what we're studying. And even the digital, I talk with my students all the time that the digital very often has some kind of support or medium, right, in interaction or through which we're actually appreciating the digital, right? So even the digital can be talked about in conversation with the analog. But I think that's one place, Deborah, that maybe And I think that's why we've swung so heavily into materiality as a lens and an approach in particularly my, at least my part of subdiscipline of art history, materiality studies, and affordance theory and the social biography of things. These are kind are really, I think, emphasized because they I think they are a little bit more distinctive of our approach to things.
That's cool. I love that. And I love that in an age where everything is more and more screens and separate, that maybe that's what we need to do is go back to engaging with objects in person more, those that specialness. That's wonderful. All right. So we named this interview series Art History on Fire, in large part because the title can be taken in both a positive and negative way. So let's start with the positive. Your department at East Tennessee State has seen a lot of growth. At the same time that art history programs elsewhere are struggling or even closing, could you tell us a bit about your program and institution, what's working and why?
Yes, and I'll try to do so very concisely. ETSU is a public regional R2 with current rather strong aspirations to an R1 status, and that is due primarily to the doctoral generation and research output of our medical sciences, which are nationally recognized. So we're really a strong medical school. With social sciences and humanities programs, right, that are also part of the university. So we are very much serving a regional student body, a significant proportion of which are first generation and come from working in middle class families. In other words, a similar background as my own as a first generation working class, middle class person. So that's as an aside, one reason why I really enjoy working where I am, including in full view of the challenges and the opportunities there. But the people that I'm working with on a daily basis are folks that I see reflections of my own experience and the very best of higher ed, right? Which is that it creates opportunity, right? And improves the life of one generation to the next, right? So just an aside for a kind of plug for, I think, the important work that the institution's doing for the people of the region. It's very much a mission-led institution, but I'm in an art and design department, which is NASAD accredited. So we have three main baccalaureate tracks that you can go on. There is a professional BFA in studio art or graphic design, and then there's a BA, a traditional kind of liberal arts degree that you can take either a studio art or an art history concentration. So, being in a place like that certainly was different than my training in very pure art history departments at Columbia, where the art school was on one side of the campus and the art history department is on the other. So, it was quite an experience to adapt my pedagogy to be relevant to three different degree tracks, right? So, I had to think about how do I serve these making and creative oriented programs, one of which is professional in its orientation, and provide my historians what they need, right? To say nothing of the fact that we participate in general education. So, what do my general education students need to get out of this class? That's a little bit about the institution. So I'm teaching four artists and designers, four historians, and for a variety, right, for general ed, and then I'll get to some other departments for which our courses serve. So when I arrived at ETSU in 2019, there had been two recent retirements of folks who'd been in serving for decades, and the program had really dwindled in enrollment. We had one declared minor and no majors when I was
Oh,
hired.
wow. Okay.
So I was hired after I should say a visiting assistant professor stint. So I was a known quantity for the department. So they kind of had a sense of whether I could deliver on the hope to do something with this program. And I had the blessing of a tenured faculty member who has multiple appointments and at the time administrative roles. So really didn't have the bandwidth to teach quite heavily in the program. But as of today, we are around 15 majors
and
Wow. 13 minors. So I would love it to be even larger, but I think I'm pretty proud of how healthy, and that is a sustaining number where we are at least bringing in every year as many new declarations as we're graduating out.
That's so impressive, Michael. Wow.
Yeah, seriously.
Some of that, I mean, a lot of that in the beginning, yes, what I was hustling myself, but now thankfully our growth has allowed us to hire a new tenure track assistant professor in non-Western who's an East Asian specialist. So now we have a three-person team. It used to be a one full-time and one half-time. So definitely have seen some growth. The question is, well, where is this growth coming from, right? At a school that is so med and natural, right, sciences, health sciences focused, right? So how are students being convinced to study this discipline under siege and whose relevance is being questioned, right?
That's my question, 100%. Can you answer that?
For the people who may tune into this podcast, I think the relieving thing I will say is that I made some very basic changes that I think can be implemented anywhere. I'm not about to present some very particular, over the top, costly, right, set of solutions. I went back to the basics, to the foundation, and made some changes. So, one of the things that I did, which cuts against the grain of, I think at least since the 90s, we've been increasingly frustrated with the surveys as thoroughly compromised, right? They have their own kind of Western colonial, right? Institutional nation state, right? Entwinement, or there's all kinds of problems, right? With the survey and the canon. And a lot of schools are increasingly doing away with the survey and trying to find other ways of teaching it. And I decided to keep the surveys and to acknowledge through the pedagogy, the way we construct the course, to treat them as overtly imperfect and flawed courses and to build in that meta level of disciplinary and historiographic awareness into the course. And part of why I didn't want to dispense with them, not because I disagree with the critiques that have been levied against survey, I think they are well put, was that to do away with those surveys would, from a very practical perspective, complicate the general education curriculum and our role in participation in it. It would create questions about the studio art and design needs, right? To say nothing, of course, of the art historian. So I doubled down and committed to the surveys. And one of the things that I noticed was by doing that approach, and of course, globalizing and diversifying the content, right? My survey one became one-third non-Western, even though it's a Western course. So I was trying to push the limit proportionally of what I could do. I was recruiting minors and majors from that class. So two-thirds of my first majors and minors, I personally recruited out of survey classes. So that's one immediate, like if I dispensed with those, I'm not sure what my recruitment avenue would have been. So I embraced the imperfect, adapted it, and it became, right, a lot of those students were gen ed. Some of my first majors were nursing students who said, I'm not that interested in nursing. And then made the switch, made the leap. Parents were, right, variously pleased, right, with that decision. One of them just finished at the Kirkorin School
Oh, wow.
at
Okay.
GWU. I was one of my very, very first students. So I would say one of those things is thinking about some of the trends of where we're going. How do we answer the call to think more critically about our discipline, but we also have to keep the pragmatic side of like how universities function and the different constituencies we're serving, and that we might actually be cutting off our nose to spite our face in recruitment by removing a class that for me has proven to be a boon for personally recruiting clearly talented students, right, who have a knack for analyzing visual material culture. So that's one I think could be applied not just at ETSU, right? It's like, think about how what a survey might look like, right? As not only a basis foundation for the discipline, but as an important recruitment ambassador kind of class, right? At the other end, it's been innovating the curriculum by consolidating the old-fashioned periodic classes. So we used to have, believe it or not, a Northern Ren, an Italian Ren, a Baroque, right? Rebecca's cheering for those who are only having a recording, right? Love that, right? But we are a faculty of 2.5 full-time, right,
Yeah.
scholars who don't have that very specific training, right? So the question was not only how do we adapt this curriculum to make it run more efficiently with the human resources and expertise we have, but as much as I love that period of history, does it need that kind of outsized proportional presence in the curriculum when there's so many other things that need to be taught?
And as much as I would like to say, yes, it does, obviously, no, it doesn't, right? We all confront those issues all the time.
Rebecca's answering my rhetorical question, right?
I mean, yeah, maybe it's a factor of my own training, right? That I'm like, yay, that's the way it should
Yes.
be. But of course, you're totally right that it has to be undone and done a different way.
So I collapse those three classes into an early modern class,
Sure.
which has its own imperfections, right? That's something I've gotten over as a teacher, is that imperfection. I lean into the incomplete and the imperfect, right? And I leverage that as an opportunity for conversations, right, in the
Sure.
classroom. But that created space for other kinds of courses with the very real reality that I'm on a 3-3. And so I can only rotate through so many courses on a 4-year rotation, right? So how do I more efficiently cover as a generalist, which I did not mention, I was hired to be a generalist, which talk about comfort zone, Rebecca, right?
I am right there with you. I am now completely a generalist, so yeah,
And
it's
I spoke about in CAA about I'm a big fan of generalist pedagogies. I think more programs should be teaching not just specialization, but competencies for cutting across our comfort zones, because some of the most rewarding experiences I've had in the classroom have been in classes where I am really being stretched almost every week. I'm prepping for something that I certainly was not doing in graduate school. So that's where we get to classes like the Monument in History or Art in the Sacred, Violence and Visual Culture, right? These become those upper level classes where we are dispensing with a kind of survey format, and we front load them with theoretical considerations relevant to that subject. And then it's a series of historically and culturally specific case studies. So we take a kind of global cross-cultural and comparative approach, right? So they get through those surveys, problematic as they are, but then I started designing these kind of thematic or topical classes that allow us to think about, again, humans around a common subject and think about their commonalities, but also importantly for comparative method, the ways that we're distinct, right, culturally as well. But all these themes were also expressly designed to be topical in their timeliness, right? They were things that were going on around our own particular moment. So they were relevant, right, in the students' eyes, even as they're also timeless, right? So that was part of the kind of curricular innovation, source the survey, adapting that, using it for recruitment, innovative curriculum, but also, I mean, I talk about efficiencies in the curriculum, right? Collapsing certain courses that maybe we are overrepresenting certain fields of art history at the upper level. And then finally was devising assessments and projects that transcend, even if they complement, the traditional art history research paper that I'm sure all of us, that was the primary means by which our art history teachers assessed our knowledge and skills. There are select contexts in which I still assign the art history research paper, very object oriented. But I've begun to think about other real world practical assignments that students can engage in that achieve the same results of honing their research skills, their critical thinking, and close looking without it resulting in a kind of assignment that feels increasingly irrelevant to the kinds of work they might be doing when they exit the academy. And I suspect we'll probably talk a little bit about those kinds of approaches later, so I won't enumerate them now. And I would say one thing I did forget, sorry, is that one of the other things I did is that art history can't exist on an island, right? Not only do I need to exist within the ecology of an art and design department, The courses that I previously described were also deliberately designed to engage with existing academic units outside of art and design. So my monuments class is currently being added to the Heritage and Museum Studies program. My medieval and classical classes are in the medieval and classical studies curriculum. Art and the Sacred is in the religious studies curriculum as a course. And I teach a class I designed called Women and Queers in the Arts, which is part of the Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies program. So I've also kind of insinuated art history into as many different parts of our university as possible, which is another way of reaching out and demonstrating the relevance and the value by engaging in other kinds of interdisciplinary, right, interactions. So that's another way that we, of course, have improved enrollment and other pathways, right, into the degree. So those are things that I think any university, right, any faculty member can experiment with those. And if you've already done them and are not working, I apologize, right? But I started with the basics rather than really kind of overthinking it. And that is so far, those changes have really paid dividends for us.
That's amazing. I have a can I ask a couple of practical questions? Do you use many adjuncts to teach the art history classes, or is it really what you and your colleagues can offer?
We unfortunately do have a pretty heavy utilization of contingent faculty, not just in art history, but in design and studio as well. We limit the adjunct teaching in art history to the survey level
Okay.
courses. So all the upper level instruction is done by one of the faculty who have a terminal degree and at least a full-time appointment. So unfortunately, the numbers, because of the general ed curriculum at the size of the institution we're at, we would not be able to teach a requisite number of sections. Of course, this is a problem, right, across. I wish we could employ people full-time with the
Yeah.
benefits and right things. But yes, we do make a good usage of adjuncts, but those adjunct-led courses tend to be our online sections rather than our brick and mortar sections. We try really hard because special things, in my view, happen in brick and mortar classroom settings. We really try to avoid those not being spaces where the faculty that they're going to have continuity and a relationship with are there. And of course, I'm not expecting an adjunct with their pay to engage in additional work like recruiting students into the major.
Right.
I want to be that faculty member who's their first point of contact in a brick and mortar class. And that's an admonishment I'll make of my colleagues who avoid the survey and similar classes because they're bothersome to teach. That is missing an opportunity as an expert in your field to convey that passion and get folks on board. If we just adjunctify the most important classes, in my view, are those first experience classes, we're missing an opportunity there. Right. How can we convey that we care about a field if we're relegating, right, some of these critical courses
Yeah.
to have a contingent relationship, right, with the department?
Right. And are often finding out a couple weeks before the semester whether or not it's even going to run, right? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, I love hearing all these strategies, Michael. And I think that is the right word, right? It sounds like you've been doing some exciting things in that very strategic and thoughtful and intentional way. So I want to turn to the other side of the equation and ask a bit about the challenges that your program is facing, and maybe hear a bit from you about where you would identify pressure points for art history as a discipline. And yeah, obviously you just talked about the contingent faculty issue, which is of course across higher ed these days. So I agree that's particularly one challenge. Do you have others you would
I would
point
say
to?
that the science of teaching and learning, right, the best practices of what our various centers at our colleges and universities are telling us is the best way for students to learn certain kinds of material is our infrastructure and our technology and our teaching spaces, at least at ETSU, is not keeping a pace with the affordances that we need to implement those best practices. So, for instance, flipping a classroom, we are scholars of the history of art and architecture. Flipping a classroom requires a certain kind of architectural setting and furnishings that are conducive to flipping a classroom, right? One of my classrooms has an arena, right, kind of large hall with chairs bolted in frontal orientation towards the sage on the proverbial stage. There's not a lot that I can do
Right.
to mitigate the architecture that is telling everyone that this is an old-fashioned lecture space and that's how this course is going to be taught, right? Or there's only one screen rather than maybe multiple screens around the room that I can subdivide with movable chairs and tables, right? Groups to work on, pair and share, come back, report, like things that we know are high impact teaching strategies. At ETSU, we have very few spaces that can be reserved or dedicated to that kind of teaching. So even in my wildest dreams of how I want to teach, I have to get really creative because art history does not even have a dedicated room at ETSU. We share them with the registrar's office, with chemistry and speech and debate, right? All of, a wide range that have different needs in those classrooms. So I can't tailor that room to reflect the specific disciplinary needs that I have. So that is a challenge, I would say, for the kinds of teaching I want to do is we're a relatively affordable, cheap program for a university to keep around, right? We don't need a lot of really expensive equipment. But even still, I find that our teaching spaces don't keep a pace with those more technologically, right, kind of equipment heavy fields where those things are replaced and kept up a lot more. It's like, we don't need anything. We can teach the same way we've always taught. It's like, well, we also could benefit from some technology and some facility, right, changes.
Well, as you say, it's not a lot, it's not a huge ask, right? A couple of projectors and some non-bolted tables and chairs.
Right.
It's
It's
not like
not.
you're looking for a new press or a dark room or you name it.
Exactly. So that I would say that is one, if we're talking about pedagogy, right, ways to actually engage in those higher impact strategies. Who do I want to get into that one as a question? Yeah, I'll go there. I also kind of referencing earlier that our discipline is arcing toward a more diverse and inclusive and self-critical, right, approach to the kind of institutional and disciplinary history. What are we doing? How are we doing it? Why are we doing it? But that really good and important work that's occurring within our discipline, and I think is important to the question of relevance, right? Are students seeing seeing themselves in and the value of, right, what we're doing is cutting across, is being cut kind of diametrically in the opposite direction of the culture war where DEI, right, this work of diversifying and being inclusive, and accessible, like all of these concerns, when you're in a political, right, when you have that political dynamic and you're working at a state institution like I do, it can create some pain points for how we design, title, right, make our reading lists, what kinds of material we're dealing with, because we know in our discipline where we need to be going, but there is the kind of surrounding socio-political atmosphere where some of that work can put scholars at in peril.
Right.
Professional peril. Trying to choose my words very, very wisely, prudently. Here, certainly in Tennessee, we have several laws that have been recently passed on the books. One is called the Protecting the Intellectual Marketplace, right? The free exchange of ideas, intellectual, ecological diversity at the institution. But the way that things are written are up for interpretation, and they can have a chilling effect on faculty who may not want to broach certain kinds of topics that might elicit strong reactions, emotions, or thoughts, right, in the classroom.
Certainly, we're seeing examples of that across the country, right? So it's not as if Tennessee is in any kind of unusual space in these kinds of ways. So I agree with you that that tension, right, between the work of the discipline to do better versus the particular cultural moment we in, that is a pressure point for sure for all of us, right? Even here in the supposedly sacrosanct private halls, right? Like we think about this for sure. And I'd like to think that that is us being responsive to our audiences as well, right? That we're not just existing in our own intellectual bubbles where these are the core issues, but really thinking about how this is playing in the world of our students and their parents. But navigating that is really complicated. You know,
Sorry, Deborah.
I was just going to say that I sometimes wonder, and I'm saying this as someone who studies South Asian and Islamic art, so you know, is coming from that perspective and has a view of traditional art history, that another way of framing it is not that the work that we're doing to be more global is about diversity or inclusion or equity. It can be about those things, but it also could just be making the art history actually more accurate. Like, we could just think of it as the art history we've been teaching has actually been really inaccurate. It's focusing on a very small percentage of the world. And that if we want to make what we're teaching, you know, just in a very straightforward way, more representative of the world in which we live, where, you know, Europe and the United States is actually a very small percentage of that, right? That we're not, it's not about doing teaching something divisive. Like, what if we thought of it as just we're just trying to do better in terms of being more accurate? And you know, the troublemaker in me would say, like, you know, it's always been about identity politics. Art history has always been about that. It was just one group was, and that actually what we're doing is taking away that and trying to be more accurate.
Right. But I think that that's exactly why I agree with you that there are other ways of framing it outside of some of the buzzwords now, right, that get kind of treated under the rubric of woke, right, or wokeness, right? But because, I mean, the political, right, can't be separated from, right,
For
all the
sure.
aspects of what we do, that even the articulation you just gave for why branching out, right, from the traditional core could still be perceived in some way as a threat or a challenge to a certain, right, to the hegemonic narratives, right, that our discipline has trafficked in, right, for generations. So that's like trying to find that way around maybe not using those words that really trigger, right, folks depending on their, right, political, right, persuasions. But in my dark moments, I do question whether even reframing in that way, right, if I'm still being perceived as detracting due attention from something that a group thinks should still remain the point of attention, or
Right.
correcting the record. And here's where we get on the work of cultural heritage narratives and the power of monuments in the way that they're the agency they have over our collective memory, even perhaps more so than textbooks and things, that like sometimes what we see as an objective act of being a historian and just being accurate and factual, if that accurate representation of the past cuts against someone's identity-based narrative of how the past was, that's where I think we get into these tensions, right? Of we see it as correcting the record, it can be seen as an attack on someone's sense of self or a group's sense of self.
No, and I do take that point. I'm being a little bit like, you
Oh,
know,
I agree. I'm not saying that to
labeled.
disagree with you. That is the
Yeah.
tension of the monuments in the monument in history course is like, are monuments about history,
Yeah.
right? And a lot of what we consider our history is more in the realm of heritage, right? And people get uncomfortable in truly historical spaces because we have to question things that in turn kind of disrupt or unmoor certain taken for granted ideas that kind of anchor us or position us in the world, right? It's kind of like our understanding of ourself in the world
Yeah.
is challenged as soon as we engage in historical.
I'm sorry, but is that not education?
But
That is the
this is
whole point of education, is it not? And
but this is
I'm
tying
an
back
honor.
to yeah, but this is tying back to one of the ways reasons why our discipline is under siege right now, right? Is that the things that we're talking about that are so inherent to what we do?
Yeah.
Well, we
you know,
get it. We get
are political, right?
Yes. This is why this is art history's relevance, is that it's always been political, right? Like, this is how, you know, it's always been about these things, and that's why it matters. But saying that at this moment, for sure, is dangerous, in depending on where you teach and who you are and what your status as a faculty member is. And actually, I'm going to jump ahead to a question that we were going to ask you later on, but it's completely relevant that in your scholarship and teaching, you work on tough topics like visual representations of violence, like contested heritage sites. So, you know, we've talked about the difficulty here. How are you handling it right now in the classroom?
I will say first, just to preface that these courses are upper level courses, so their enrollments are by design small to facilitate discussion. But I also require any student who registers for a course, certainly one with sensitive topic, they have to have a correspondence with me where I inform them in advance what this course is going to be about, what the content's going to be, and some of the guidelines and expectations for conduct of everyone in the class. So they have to actually agree that they are going to be prepared to do the kind of work and confront the topics of the course and be respectful and open-minded, right? All of that before I even issue a permit for them to come in the course. So
And what is that? And do students then step away, or do they all like jump in?
some say, oh, that's maybe a little heavier, a little more difficult than I imagined it was going to be. Or some will say, I love the class, but I'm in two other seminars this semester. That's going to be a little too much work for me, right? But it's partly, before I get into the kind of controversial, right, discussions, how we manage that side of it, it's also my effort as an upper level class. I ask a lot of my students in upper level classes in terms of workload, is to be respectful of the fact that my first generation students are very often working jobs to get through school and are
Sure.
often primary caretakers for aging parents or grandparents. So I want them to make an informed workload decision about their next semester before they get into a class that's going to demand a lot intellectually and emotionally from them, right?
Sure. That makes total sense. And we don't have to, you don't have to unpack your whole pedagogy, but if you have some,
No, of
that would
course.
be cool. But if you have a
But
couple of thoughts or
yes,
tips.
I would say, I mean, one of the reasons why I want to teach these classes is that I think our classrooms, courses like, right, that deal with these controversial topics are maybe some of the only remaining contexts where we can come together in good faith with certain ground rules to be open-minded, to listen to the other, where the ethic of the classroom is to understand rather than to win an argument, right, or to lob talking points at us. So one of the kind of reasons is maybe the larger high-minded goal of education, the democratic mission of education, that we are hopefully producing people who can engage in respectful discourse where you're truly actively listening to someone else and not make assuming the worst of your interlocutor, not making assumptions, right? But really engaging in that difficult work, right? So that's right, kind of the ethic of why I'm one of the ethics why I'm teaching these classes. They're incredibly relevant. But I would say, how do I approach this, or how do I deal with these things? I did kind of create a list, because I was like reflecting on this question of how do I actually navigate this. And some of this I've learned through engagement with Centers for Teaching and Learning, again, benefiting from people who know a lot more than I do about how to teach effectively. For plan discussions, which because I prepare my classes the way that I do, I don't often get unexpected flare-ups in class. So that's one thing we can speak to if you want, but I'll talk more about these planned discussions, right, that we have. Is to make sure first and foremost that the purpose for even broaching the topic that we're broaching is clearly communicated, right? And its relevance to the course, right? So people aren't just left to speculate as to why in the world are we talking about this. I preface the conversation with why are we having this conversation, right? What is this about? I establish ground rules, right, for the discussion. I keep students focused on the common issue, try to keep us from straying too much from that focus. And that's usually oriented around whatever sets of readings, monuments, works of art, right, or visual material culture, keeping us where we have a common set of curated things that, again, I've intentionally selected, right, for a reason, so that we don't kind of free associate too much. When we get to a stop, I mean, I see myself as a facilitator, right, of the kind of the flow and focus, that when we get to an impasse or people are getting reticent to speak, I will sometimes just cut that kind of difficult pregnant silence, which is the question like, why do you think we're having difficulty right now kind of articulating what we're thinking, right? Give that space for a moment for maybe someone not to think, oh, I got to be an it has to be an academic point all the time, but someone to maybe express the emotion, right, that they're feeling. Like, what, not assuming that when students aren't talking, it's because they didn't do the readings, right, or because they're not prepared. Sometimes we don't feel comfortable talking for a reason that we might lean into that could be productive, right, for the discussion. And then finally, I try to end those conversations with summarizing as objectively and as well as I can what we talked about, what the different viewpoints were, and then what the main takeaways from that discussion actually are as they relate to the course. So I try to leave that dialogical space with those ground rules and be more of a facilitator, but it's that delicate dance of also keeping people on topic, right? Because again, with the expectations we have from legislatures, we need to always keep the course relevance and our respective expertise in mind so that we don't stray into areas where they are not course related or we're speaking out of professional turn. So those are some of the things that I've learned from kind of teaching in Research Center that have really worked so far. And I think it's just ultimately about being transparent and open about why we're doing what we're doing.
It sounds like you're, I have to say, it sounds like you're an amazing teacher. I wish I when I have these conversations, like I feel like I want to take a class with you now.
I appreciate it. Likewise, I wish I'd had more, certainly more Islamic art and architecture exposure when I was in school. That was a woeful blank spot that I've had to remediate as I'm teaching.
I'm ready. My wheels are turning, Deborah. Maybe we should add a field trip component to our research project. Right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Go visit people, sit in their classes. Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I love hearing your strategies, Michael, and it sounds like the students are coming out of those experiences really feeling good about what you're offering them, right? In terms of that democratic ideal, right, of education. I appreciate that. Maybe this is a good point to kind of segue into some of the other learning models that you use. So we're kind of working our way backwards through the questions that I sent you, but you in your university profile, there's a lot of mentioning about experiential learning and practical training and things like that. And I'd be super curious to hear about what those approaches look like for you. And again, thinking about this in a larger disciplinary sense, is that a pathway for art history, a role that art history can play, right, in preparing students for work, life outside of academia?
I mean, I think so. I
Mm-hmm.
think that we certainly will continue to produce for the foreseeable immediate future teachers, right, at varying levels and museum professionals and auction house, right, dealers and the like, right, the kind of bread and butter that will continue to occur. But we also need to respond, right, to the kind of shifting economies, right, the different pathways that students have outside of academia. And I mean, we are in an increasingly image-oriented world and market, right? So again, kind of leaning into the particular strength of art history that we can impart those critical analytical approaches to not just consuming imagery, but really thinking about, right, what we're looking at is really critical. But in terms of experiential learning and practical training, I've approached that on three different levels, in my classes. This again for practical advice for folks who are like, well, how do I kind of land soft or, maybe not do something grand? I think you can start by doing independent or collaborative in-class exercises, right? Not an entire class, not even an assessment that you're going to grade, right? Something that folks can work independently or collaboratively where they are demonstrating their assimilation of the material through some kind of active doing, right? Some kind of practical application. And I'll just give an example. So I was teaching a few semesters ago a course on collecting and the history of collecting. And we were in our unit on the cabinets of curiosity. Great early modern, right? European topic. But they had just read and discussed some primary readings, right, on this phenomenon, right, in the history of collecting. And I actually brought to class hundreds and hundreds of random objects of raw to finished materials of the kinds of things that one might expect to find in a cabinet of curiosity in the early modern period. And I actually put them out and I put up masking tape shelves on the walls and I had them break up and they had to construct their own cabinet of curiosity, right? Picking various objects, right? And then they had to report back to the class as that collector why they amassed the objects they did and what they say about themselves or their understanding of the early modern globe, right? So very low tech, right? Hands-on activity where you can practically demonstrate that students actually understand conceptually, right, what's happening in a cabinet of curiosity, right? Second is individual class-wide assessments, right? Or collaborative class-wide assessments. So one class I taught was the history of printmaking, which was a global class. And that class was taught in COVID, so I also had to adapt to the remote learning context. But thankfully, I'd already anticipated, whether it was brick and mortar, doing a collaborative class exhibition using ArtSteps, which is a VR gallery space. Or I
Yeah, I know
divided
that.
into teams. They had to write a joint proposal for an exhibition to me. They had to divide up the research tasks, what parts of the gallery different groups were going to do. They had to select the objects. They had to come up with the plans. They had to basically execute an exhibition, right, over the course of the semester. And I had several class days that were studio days rather than traditional art historical discussion or slideshow days. They had just work session days. And that class chose an exhibition on contemporary Black women engaged in print. So I learned a lot from that class because I was expecting, oh, they're going to pick some obvious, right, Rembrandt, right, or something as their focus. And then they ended up working in a topic that actually is quite challenging to research, right, and write about, which also stretched my capacities as an instructor. So that, of course, is a one more standard activity where they're learning how museum professionals and curators like actually put together a show, but it was again a kind of experiential and practical based class. Another class that I taught last semester is called Art in Appalachia because our institution is based in Appalachia. It is expressly dedicated to Appalachian serving the region, and we have a university museum that heavily collects its collection strategy. Is Appalachian material and visual culture. So what my students did is we actually taught in the museum, and not only did we integrate objects into every single unit, which was also about handling properly, right? Thinking about the preservation, conservation, archiving these objects. Every student was assigned an object, or not assigned, they picked an object that had never been studied before in the collection. And through the course of the semester, they cataloged, studied, researched, and wrote catalog essays that now are part of public knowledge. They're on our public-facing website, so students were contributing to knowledge about an object that hitherto had not ever been researched. So that was really great for students we're not in a region with a lot of major museums. So getting students in front of actual, again, physical material objects and getting them to think about how you handle them, how do you look at them as physical things, not digitized, right? Pixels on a screen, right? Or something like that. And then fourth and finally, our entire classes that are experiential or practically based. And the Art in Appalachia is I might say also an example of that because they're doing a class-wide course, but the whole course is in the space of the museum and is all about navigating the space of the museum. And it's actually a meta-level course about Appalachia and the problematic cultural narratives that are written about this region and that the artifacts and architecture are used to kind of buttress in problematic ways. It's also a kind of metacritical course. But I also did a study abroad in Greece that I co-teach with a graphic design colleague. Again, bringing expertise and perspective that I do not have. And it's actually based in Athens for 3 weeks. And we do three case studies, one ancient, one medieval, and one early modern. Our early modern one, Deborah, is on Ottoman Athens.
Oh, cool.
So we actually confront every week the students with a specific cultural heritage, tourism, or interpretive problem that confronts an individual site in Athens. So the Acropolis, the Daphne Monastery, and Ottoman Athens. And these are questions that we make students work in collaborative interdisciplinary teams to solve real-world cultural heritage problems, ranging from problematic interpretation to even practical things like wayfinding, accessibility, right? So they really are thinking about how to, other pathways, right, for a historian or designer is thinking about, well, how do we actually, this important work of the historical research and the narratives that we're telling, like, this is a kind of public-facing, right, kind of history where our histories aren't going to be very useful if they're if the typography of the signs isn't usable, or the spaces that we want people to interact with aren't accessible, right, to varying bodies. So they're thinking about a variety of issues that confront our discipline that we can't often appreciate when we're sitting in a classroom, right, looking at things that can be decontextualized. Right, are difficult to keep contextualized, and for students to realize that the things we're looking at have biographies. The Acropolis, if we just fix it in the 5th century, we're not talking about the church or the mosque or the blown up monument or the scrubbed clean of any Ottoman trace, right? Post independence monument, right? So they're really thinking about that this thing is in the flow of time, and we are also intervening with it and making meaning. Right, with it. So those are a few kind of examples of varying from just quick assignments in class all the way up to entire classes that are dedicated to kind of being embedded experientially and practically, right, on various kinds of problems.
Very cool. And what I'm thinking about with the Athens one, but also the one set in the museum is that these are also kind of they're doing public art history in a way, right? That these are things that are going to they imagine a general public for them. And that's, another thing that I think we're thinking about in this research is what is the role of public art history? And so kind of pivoting to another question about that for you, that you've done a lot of work with Smart History, which is a digital online platform, open access. And how does that compare to you as a form of public scholarship, in comparison to the things that you're doing in these classes or to like exhibitions or art criticism or things like that?
Well, as a corollary to the previous assignments, I really love that you summarized it that way, Deborah, because that is something that those experiential based assignments are meant to give students a sense that they're not just doing assessments for because I need to grade something,
Right.
right? Class. I want them to feel like they are making some meaningful contribution to society, to a public, right? The ArtSteps exhibition is published. It is publicly viewable and tourable, right? For folks to learn more about contemporary Black females, right, who are making awesome prints, right, or this idea of designing for better cultural heritage, right. So that I think that spirit of making art history not just relevant but like open and useful and available to a wide number of people outside the academy, outside the right hallowed halls, right, in which we're engaging, right, in certain kinds of conversations. That I think is a virtue of smart history. As well, is that it is free, right? If you have internet, you can access it. You don't have to pay any money, right? So there's a kind of democratic accessibility to this site, presuming you, of course, can read English, right? Which is the language in which all of this is published. And these are high quality, expert written and expert vetted contributions. My contribution that I wrote was peer reviewed by 4 people. I've never even had an article in a journal reviewed by four people, right? So there is a scrupulousness, right? A dedication to the quality, informational quality of what's going up there, which is a great antidote to the massive mis and disinformation that just floats out in the internet, right? Relevant to art and architectural and just generally cultural history. I also love that then I can cut the cost of my students. Like, I use Smart History for my survey classes, so they're not buying a really costly book. But I love that it's global, it's cross-cultural, that it enlists, I mean, dozens and dozens and dozens of scholars around the world to write these essays, which again allows art history to be dialogic. The traditional survey book is one, two, right, authors who don't have the requisite expertise to talk about all of these different chapters of the book and have a kind of red thread, a kind of master grand narrative that they're trying to tie all these chapters together, where Smart History leans into manifold and multiple conflicting, right, different kinds of narratives and letting different authorial voices, right, and styles emerge, right? So again, it kind of not presenting a tidy, right, history, but leaning into history actually being plurivocal and unresolved and unfinished, right, work. And speaking of the unfinished, it's dynamic. If we learn something new, we can update the art history website or the essay, right? It's not this published thing that now is fixed, right, in form, that is dynamically updatable, right, and can be kept current with wherever we are, right, as art historians. I feel like I'm like pitching with Smart History. I know monetary, benefit.
It sounds like you found it rewarding personally, right? To be part of that endeavor to make the art
Absolutely.
history active that way.
Absolutely. And I would say it made me a better scholar. And I would say if there's one kind of selfish reason one might get more involved in public art history is that once we have to try to convey information to populations beyond the small group of specialists who understand our jargon and take for granted, right, certain the self-evident importance of what we're working on, when we have to actually explain the importance of what we're working on, convey to an educated layperson, right, the topic at hand, it has actually made me a much better communicator in my more specialized research and actually made me speak to a broader audience than I had been before I started engaging in public art history. And I'm optimistic that our field is becoming more receptive to public art history as a legitimate kind of scholarly activity. That wasn't always the case. But I think even engaging in that, it ends up improving even your more specialized scholarship because I had to stop and really think about, have I really conveyed why I'm working on this, why this is important, right? Really laid it out clearly. So you can't really write obfuscating, dense, right, kinds of text for Smart History, right?
Hopefully your peer reviewers would edit that out. That
Yes.
sounds like a win across the board, though, right? Obviously successful out in the digital world and successful for students of all types and
Right.
successful for you to be part of it. And that's certainly what we learned from our interview with Laura Holtzman, right? That the notion of an engaged art history was a sort of positive practice that could move the field into spaces where maybe it's only really dabbled before.
And I think like exhibitions are great, but you've got to go to them, right? So that there are barriers, right, to exhibitions, whether it's traveling or admissions fees, or even the fact that museums are not always spaces that folks really feel like they want to be in, right? And art criticism can be really alienating in its own way in the very particular rhetoric and terminology that particularly contemporary art criticism engages in. It feels like you need to be initiated into a specialized, right, kind of knowledge to really understand
I
what is.
mean, there are critics, just to be fair, there are critics who are trying to fight against that, right? And there
Yes,
are certainly
to be fair.
vehicles, digital and other vehicles. I think
Yes,
about
to be
Jason
fair.
Farrago's work and that sort of thing. So, but I
Absolutely.
hear what you're saying
Point
here.
taken. But even to say that is exactly the kind of work that I think pairs well with Smart History, where accessibility is not just about connectivity and the freeness of it. It's also is the prose, right? extending a hand and inviting someone into a conversation rather than kind of erecting this ivory tower of like, oh, well, this discourse is for this group of five people, right, who met at a conference somewhere, right?
And
So.
I don't know if you all saw the article in the Chronicle recently that said it was a note to humanists saying that the digital I'm not digital that the public humanities will not save us. Did anybody read that?
I
I saw
No,
it, but I did not
not
read
that,
it.
no.
Yeah.
What
Okay.
did you think about it? Or about that?
We'll let that. I mean, I wonder about two things. Off the top of my head, I wonder about sort of density and overload, right? If all of us are like, okay, to make the case for our existence, we all have to go out into the world and do this. You know, at what point do we saturate the market, right? For hearing of from like, how many writers can Smart History really have, right? We can't all write for Smart History. Oh, that'd be sort of interesting. And second, operating in the public sphere requires certain sets of skills, and it's not always a friendly place, right? Most of us are trained and conditioned to work within higher ed, within the academy. So are we doing good work out in the public realm, or are we in fact exacerbating some of the problems that, to your point, that exist in our field and what we're trying to be metacritical about? So those are just two ideas that.
Yeah, I definitely think public art history has to proceed in the ethic of good social justice and community engaged work, is that we also have to be collaborative and open-minded and have humility that we may not have certain knowledge that other people we may be interacting and serving are better placed or have forms of expertise that we need to appreciate. So certainly not going in and saying, here's the service, right, that I'm providing you. Aren't you happy? Right. But we have to come with the humility of meeting people and also listening, right, to what folks want to say.
And
And
not to be stereotypical, but those are not adjectives that are normally applied to art historians.
no.
Humble and good listeners and collaborative.
Goes back to why my way to art history was so circuitous, and never even mentioned how art history has certain connotations. And I was from a working class, blue collar, first gen family. I was like, that's not for me. Like, that is not a space or a discipline where folks like me have a place. I mean, my family didn't really go to those kinds of spaces, right, growing up. So certainly, to your point,
And
Rebecca.
I keep thinking about the art historian in the Woody Allen movie Midnight in Paris, right? Who's such a snob and is just so like off the cuff, pretentious and annoying. And you know, again, to Deborah's point, that's part of what we're fighting against, right? So the kind of public art history you're talking about that your students are doing, that you're doing, are actually really important in countering those stereotypes that are out there. All right, shall we go to the culminating question, the
Final
question of
question.
questions, our final question? What do you think the future of art history is? There's an easy one. In particular, are there actions we can take now to ensure the best income outcome? Sorry, income would be interesting too, but the best outcome for our field? And just to be clear for our listeners, that's a question we've asked all of our interviewees.
Yeah, this is definitely the toughest question of them all, because we spend so much of our time as historians thinking about whether the relative or more distant past, right? So orienting ourselves towards where we're going or where we anticipate going definitely is a feat of its own for the historian. There was one, since we're referencing recent op-eds, right, that have been published. There was one this month, published by Joan Key, who's the director of the Institute of Fine Arts at NYU, published in the Brooklyn Rail. It's the current October issue that I believe is called something like "Why Art History Must Leave Its Home," something of that kind, and. Joan Key, there's this memorable quote towards the beginning of the article. that kind of sets up the piece, saying, "I wonder what might happen if we stopped defending our institutional patches and started flooding other fields with critical visual analysis." And then she goes on to develop this concept of applied art history, albeit not in the sense that we might think of preparing art historians for specific vocational, right, highly technical jobs, which you might argue is what we have been doing for a while. But honing in on, again, for her, what is this quintessential thing that art history can teach and enable others to do? And it's actually teaching visual thinking, right? A certain kind of slow, still, deep, engaged way of looking that for her is actually has democratic and kind of social and political implications, because she says, actually, we should be getting into these interdisciplinary or cross-disciplinary spaces where we're teaching medical students, not just through by looking at like European painting, how to look at bodies in a particularly acute or attentive way, but actually even to look at the history of medicine, its illustrations, its photographs, formally to think about ways in which bias is encoded in the very ways, right, that we represent, right? That representation is not this neutral thing, as it's so often treated as a kind of documentary form in other disciplines. Like, well, actually, that supposed neutrality of these documentary media is exactly where art historians intervene, right? And say, well, actually, let's talk about the history of racism or sexism, right? Or various kinds of phobias as they manifest in the visual record of medicine.
Yeah, 100%. That's super exciting.
Right. So Joan Key, I can't follow her all the way to her conclusion where she wants us to abandon the ramshackle home of our institution and to get out there and do this work of essentially engaging these other disciplines and getting them to think visually when, as she claims, many of them are not thinking right visually in the way that they might benefit from thinking. I think there's still some repairs and foundational right kinds of adjustments that can be made to the proverbial home. I'm not willing to completely abandon art history as such as a discipline. And I think that gets back to a point earlier I made about I don't think I've pushed it far enough for myself at my own institution, but the fact that I'm trying to connect with different disciplines through the courses that I'm designing is one of those steps I think without abandoning the house, we can extend the hand and start engaging other curriculums on campus to help demonstrate the utility and the value of our particular way of thinking, right? About that is visually driven way of thinking that can actually affect transformations, right, within those disciplines. Hopefully not, Deborah, to the point where we've been appropriated and are no longer needed because they've learned, right? They've taken a page from us. But maybe Joan Key would say, if we've done that, what an amazing accomplishment. Let's close shop. Right. If everyone has assimilated the toolkit and we have improved the kind of democratic right notion right of or character of society, now people are thinking about images in the kind of critical ways, right? Exposing the ways in which images have served some pretty unfortunate ends, right, throughout history.
So I have to say, I love this, that I feel like you are very optimistic. You have an optimistic view of this, of what our history can do, what all of these things. And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking about discussions on my campus and very much right now, our African American studies and women and gender studies departments are very much at that phase of people saying, well, but we do that in our classes. Like, we don't need these departments. We can do that ourselves. And I think our history also that happens a little bit, like, oh, we deal with visual material in our courses. And my thought back is that they are, and here I'm criticizing academics, and I would include art historians in this, all of us, of thinking that, like, we don't need other people, like, we can do it. And so, my thought is, sure, I could go out and have those conversations, but I think my colleagues would be like, we don't need you to have that conversation. We can do it ourselves. So, how do we convince these other disciplines that we have something unique? to give to them. Like, convincing the students isn't the problem. It's convincing our peers when we're operating in institutions where there's limited resources and people are really kind of, at least at my institution, there's a sense of competition between the disciplines, you know.
And that I unfortunately, I'm not sure what the solution would be. Certainly, I think that the students are an easier sell, as you pointed out, but we are in a situation where we have a not dissimilar budget model, as we call it at my institution, which is very much student credit hour generated. So there is a kind of divide and conquer effect that occurs where recognizing the value of sending your students to another discipline is to give up a certain cache of dollars that are so desperately needed, right, to support our department. So that, I mean, I'm not an administrator, so I don't, typically have to confront some of those realities. But that point is well made, right? Is that there is this contest over a finite number of resources or amount of resources, right? That on a very practical, on a practical level, hinders work that might otherwise be done. 'Cause, I mean, maybe I'm too much of an optimist, or I thought if maybe if we remove some of these things, some of our colleagues might be more willing to acknowledge the particular expertise, right, that we have that just can't be reduced to, well, we work with visual things too, right? Because
Right. And maybe I'm too cynical. So that was, you know, that would be a I and maybe it's also both ways that art historians also need to be more open to like that we need to model this in both ways. I don't know.
yeah, I mean,
And
I
both
think
of you are
so.
pretty optimistic, right? I mean, I think you're right. I think you're right to what you're just saying, Michael. I think you're right. I mean, you know, just looking at this Joan Key article, which I obviously need to read more fully, but you know, the last paragraph says, or we can walk away from it. I mean, it's a little easier to say when you're the director of the premier art historical institute in the country, a little harder to do when you're the sole faculty member in a regional university, right?
And yeah, the questions of, yeah, I mean, I did kind of get left thinking, oh, okay, applied art history. I can see where this might go. And then it was ultimately geared towards, well, let's do this and step outside of this is, but I'm not sure where that kind of like perpetuation of the kind of close analytical, right, critical thinking that we're trying to promote. Like, if we step outside the house, like, how are we actually generating across generations that competency, right? Because it needs to be taught, right? We can't take for granted that once it's conveyed, it's just going to self-perpetuate, right? There need to be people who are there reminding people that the visual requires critical engagement, right? It is not this transparent form of communication, right? It needs to be dissected
And
and
maybe that's the optimism that I'm hearing from both of you, that fundamentally we believe in the discipline and what it contributes. We just got to figure out these little minor logistical problems.
right. And kind of maybe meeting people like Joan Key halfway is that, like, what I'm not wanting to do is retreat within the house, spackle things up and say, let's just keep producing professors and curators, right? That I
Agreed.
don't want it to abandon either in an era where more and more and more people are actually going to museums, right? But maybe we can refurbish or remodel or add an addition to the house
Porch,
that
an
allows
L.
a porch or even, right, some or maybe less hostile architecture, to use a metaphor, that
There you go.
invites different people in, right? So maybe it's not, maybe that having a house isn't the problem. Maybe it's the architecture.
Maybe we need an L that would attach it to the garage or something, right? And bring more people in. Okay, I would probably push this metaphor. Michael, thank you so much for your time and for this great conversation. This has been terrific to hear about all your successes, and I really do appreciate the optimism about the field. It's heartwarming.
I'm an optimist to a fault, but also like in the times we're in, it's for me, it's a necessary bulwark.
Well, it was wonderful and inspiring, really, truly inspiring to hear all the things that you're doing and what you're doing in the classroom. And so, yeah, thank you so much for engaging us in this conversation. So, thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.